It's Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, I meet Mighty Boosh director Paul King as he releases his debut feature film, Bunny and the Bull. Zan Brooks joins me to review the week's releases, including César Sweeper Seraphine and box office phenomenon Paranormal Activity. And in these dumbed-down days, who said philosophy couldn't make for good cinema? Well, for her film, Examined Life, Astra Taylor takes 8 leading thinkers onto the streets of New York to enlighten us with their theories. Yes, it's big ideas about the big screen. It's Film Weekly.
Here, drink this.
Thank you.
Nice. Warm milk.
It's delicious.
Farm dog. You not like my milk?
No, not at all. It's just I'm more used to cow's milk.
That's a scene there from director Paul King's Bunny and the Bull, a visually arresting debut feature from the man behind the Mighty Boosh television series. The film tells the tale of a journey through the memory of our protagonist, Stephen, played by Edward Hogg, and his friend Bunny, played by Simon Farnaby, as they recall a trip around Europe in search of love, meeting various oddball characters. In fact, the man you heard in the clip was Julian Barrett himself from the Mighty Boosh, playing Attila the Bear Man. Well, anyway, to tell me more about the genesis of this weird idea that is Bunny and the Bull, I'm joined in the studio by director Paul King. Welcome to Film Weekly, Paul.
Very nice to see you too.
Saw you at the London Film Festival where you were nominated for a Sutherland Award for Most Imaginative First Feature.
Yes, that was extremely flattering. There's kind of quite an alarming track record of people who've won it, but fortunately I avoided joining their ranks, so I haven't besmirched that.
But I thought it was a very just nomination, because imaginative is what Bunny and the Bull is. In fact, it is a flight of imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted that idea that it's not entirely reliable memories. You know, maybe I'm too affected by reading Salman Rushdie novels in my adolescence, but I really like the idea that when you remember holidays, it's sort of through snapshots and souvenirs and kind of anecdotes that you tell your friends, and they sort of become the way that you remember the story, you know.
So it's the journey that photographs could inspire, which is what happens to your character,
exactly,
Stephen.
And I really like the idea that I kind of think this is something films can do really well, is kind of reflect the psychological state of the character through the camera work or the set. And it's not an area that's explored as much as it could be, but
no, especially not in the way that you've done it as well. I mean, I don't know if is yours because you wanted to create a new aesthetic for film, or is it because you only had £3.50 to spend on a budget and you couldn't afford massive special effects?
No, I mean, I suppose I think because Warp Films, who made it, and they're good at, you know, stretching the shoestring a long way, and I mean, no, there wasn't very much money, but I don't think that means you can't try something ambitious.
But you do. I mean, people are obviously, as they would, cashing in on the fact that you work with the Mighty Boosh, with Noel and Julian, and in those TV shows, they go on journeys to the Arctic Circle. They go on journeys in Heads.
And we've done some big. Well, we've done some. Yeah, I suppose we did a kind of we did a sort of inner space type one, a kind of Fantastic Voyage one, and we did a But there's been quite a lot of road movie stuff. But what I really wanted to do in this was, I mean, and that sort of lives in a sort of surreal parallel universe where there's kind of bubblegum men and men made of kind of Betamax tape. And, you know, I love the Boosh, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't have spent 5 years slaving away on it.
Did you do all of that?
Yeah, I did all the TV show and I did 2 live tours as well.
So you did the zoo ones and the shop ones?
Yeah,
really?
And the flat
and
ones.
And the flat ones.
Yeah, so I've done all their TV show. But I kind of, I mean, some of the techniques we used in that were very kind of, they're very cheap, basically. If you don't have to use lots of green screen and use lots of back projection and you get all your effects ideas from the 1950s, it's sort of a little cheaper. But I kind of wanted to build on that and sort of, and as I say, sort of try and get inside the character's head. So it sort of starts really simplistic. And we got lots of animated backdrops and lots of stop frame animation in this and sort of models. And for me, a big influence was Paddington Bear late, you know, the Ivor Wood animations, which are so beautiful.
Strangely enough, at the London Film Festival, I asked Wes Anderson, you know, what I thought one of the main influences on Fantastic Mr. Fox was Paddington Bear, and he admitted that it was.
Well, that's because there's Paddington Garage in it or something, yeah, exactly. Isn't it? That's really name checked. Yeah. But I did wonder what that made me start looking at the other garages and other shops. But anyway,
there's no Trumpton.
No, there isn't, is there?
No, but there is. Yours is Trumpton influenced in some way.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I really like those. I like the naivety.
Yours is not as animated as his. You only have sort of bits of animation.
It's semi-animated, really. I mean, we've got bits of stop frame, and I suppose I like the mixture, which is sort of I don't know. It just sort of, it seemed a good way. I really like that story from Raging Bull, that kind of the rings are built in different sizes to reflect Jake LaMotta's emotional state. And I heard this anecdote that I don't know if it's true, but I assume it is, about Schmidt, that when his, which is beautiful,
the Jack
film
Nicholson
well.
With yeah. Alexander Payne.
Yeah, he's one of my absolute hero directors.
Paul,
he's really under. Yeah. He's sort of not the name people
he's
bandy
the best.
Around.
He's the future Billy Wilder.
Yeah, he really is a master, I think, and he's only made great films, which is bloody impressive.
Which is good going, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I really like her. But apparently when his wife's died in that, and there's that beautiful sequence, they rebuilt the sets all 50% larger so he'd look more isolated.
Really?
You go, that is why you're such a great filmmaker, because you don't even really notice it. But I wanted to explore that and push that. And so it's kind of about this character who's filed away his memories but not processed them. And, you know, and it's kind of, I was sort of, you know, when you split up with somebody, or maybe you don't, maybe you've only had the most beautiful.
Never happens to me. I do the splitting.
You
Paul.
Do the split. Yeah. You're the dumper. How horrific.
No, I wish.
But you know, if people sort of go, oh, what happened with you? You're great. Or, you know, and you sort of tell it, you get it down to like two sentences. You go, well, I was quite busy at work, and then you moved, and the house was traumatic. And you go, that's not what happened. That was, you know, a year of pain, or, you know, a story about somebody who's died or something. But it becomes this anecdotalizing that you sort of need to do. And I wanted to kind of go, he hasn't done that, this character. So he needs to start at first principle. So when he first goes into it, it's kind of Paddington Bear backdrops. It's very naive and simplistic. And as it goes on, it gets much more kind of deconstructed.
I thought that was, it was a great idea. I mean, and the box full of, the sort of Pandora's box of ideas that you open up must have almost been limitless as well. Because, I mean, you journey through Europe, but I mean, you could have gone anywhere and met
Well, exactly. I mean, yeah, I was sort of one quite late in the process. I mean, I knew I wanted them to get to Spain, but I sort of got a bit travel envy and thought maybe I should send them on the Orient Express, and maybe they should, you know, go to Siberia. And I sort of kept it in Europe because interrailing is such a kind of iconic thing, I think. I like that sort of rite of passage that interrailing is. And I can't think of an interrailing movie, although you probably can.
I think, but they're bad ones with Americans. I think Hostel.
Is that an interrailing movie?
And there's another one where
I don't watch too much torture porn.
Right.
You can probably tell from the film.
When you say that Nolan and Julian are doing their own film, is you got them for this film, but obviously not for the lead.
No,
I mean, it did seem a bit odd. It seems quite British industry of us to kind of have a sort of, not a spin-off of the Bush, but obviously the spirit of the Bush lives on in your film. The humour is similar, yeah, the direction is similar, as you say.
Well, the direction's obviously.
Yeah, I mean, but not to have them in there. Was it a willful choice not to have them in the lead? Because it's sort of like, well, it would have been quite nice to have them in the lead.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I obviously I think Ed and Simon are brilliant, and I don't want anyone to go, oh, I wish they'd, you know, I don't want people to go, I wish I was watching the Mighty Boosh movie, because it isn't, you know, and it's set in a less willfully surreal universe, and hopefully it's, you know,
not that less willfully, I have to say, because there's an animatronic bull in there, there's a
bull is representing a bull, I suppose, is my point, and in the Boosh it would be, you know, there'd be Clockwork Johnny, a man made of spoons,
yes,
and
true.
Here it's kind of, you know, this is a...
You have a bear man, and you have...
These
are good things.
No. It's I mean, obviously, I like the sense of humour in the Bush, and I'm not going to run away from that. And I think they're great in it, but. I also slightly think Noel could not play a nervous nerd who can't get the girl.
No, that's true.
That would be the worst bit of casting of all time. And I'm not sure Julian should really be playing the charismatic, boozy gambler. And also, all those stories that about Bunny are based on Simon's grandfather. So I think if I'd gone, I've kind of raided your life story for this film, and I'm casting somebody else, he would literally smash me.
He would get upset. One thing it did remind me of is With Noel and I.
Oh,
which is a film stuck in a flat, really, apart from a bit when they go up to Uncle Monty's.
Yes, kind of place. Yes.
And it's about...
I love the flat in that. It's a great...
It's a great flat.
Scene,
and I thought
yeah.
that...
I love the film.
Much of your design... Well, who doesn't love the film?
Only idiots.
much of the mess in your flat or in his flat was... And the gunge was kind of at the yeah. bottom of the sink of in Paul McGann's flat. And also, it seemed to me a film about sort of one less flamboyant man's infatuation with another.
Yes, I think that's probably very true. And yeah, I suppose if you think hard about Withnail, yes, because Withnail's also sort of not the lead character in that film, but he's the title character. And I suppose I've done the same thing, although I've now only thought of that.
Oh, okay.
So slight apologies. But no, to me, it was, yeah, I really like that sort of thing about friendship and those unhealthy friendships where you kind of you put too much energy into one other person. And it's really kind of Brideshead Revisited was my kind of model.
What does come out of Bunny and the Bull is this very unique sort of visual sensibility, but,
right.
Which you say is inspired by Paddington.
Yes, all from Paddington. He whispers in my ear through his sandwich.
Is that something that you can continue? I mean, do you do other stuff? Or now you're going to have to kind of do sort of animated Flights of Fancy in whatever you do?
No, I don't think so. I hope not. I mean, I think sort of if you've... I mean, I'm glad it looks nice and people seem to agree it looks nice, although, you know, who agrees on anything, but apart from Withnail Eyes, brilliant. But yeah, I mean, I hope that stuff I do it has a visual interest because they're the sort of films I want to
make.
Cinema.
You know, we need visual.
Yeah, exactly. It's a visual medium, and I kind of, and that was something I was really, you know, that's again why I didn't want to do the sitcom-y sort of film. You know, you sort of see a few of these British films where you sort of go, oh, it sort of feels a bit like a cash in, and I hope this is too weird to be a cash in. If you were going to cash in, you wouldn't
no,
do it
I'm
with an animatronic
accusing,
bull.
Normally, no, I would accuse you of a cash in. It sort of doesn't cash in enough.
Maybe it should. Yeah, this is so destined for cult obscurity that we can't accuse anyone of making any money. We're certainly all broke. But
it is an absolute pleasure to have you on Film Weekly. I think it's sort of a unique talent, actually. We've only had one. We make mixed films like yours. If it fails, it fails gloriously. And if it succeeds, it will succeed with a bit of failure attached to it as well, which I kind of like.
Oh,
because,
good.
Because there's always this kind of...
That doesn't sound great when you put it like
it
that.
It doesn't. Maybe it doesn't.
No.
But it is. It's sort of about... It's not about a loser at all.
No, it's about failure, definitely.
Yeah.
There's a Beckettian edge of...
That's what I meant.
In the best
way. I should have said it has a Beckettian edge.
Thanks, I'd have taken that much more gratefully.
So with nods to Beckett and Paddington, I can safely say it's the first British film that certainly has done that.
Thank you.
Paul King, congratulations. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Bunny and the Bull goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 27th of November. Joining me to journey through the memories of the past week's film releases is Zam Brooks, Guardian critic at large, who's been rubbing shoulders with Charles and Camilla, have you not, at the Royal Film Premiere, or at least you've seen the film that was the Royal Film Premiere.
I've seen the film, and I was an honoured guest and a humble lickspittle at the Royal Premiere.
Yeah, it was Peter Jackson's Lovely Bones, which people are looking forward to.
They are indeed.
Zam, we'll be reviewing this week, we'll be looking at a French winner of 7 Césars, Seraphine. We'll be looking at a film that's made record box office in ratio to its cheapo budget, Paranormal Activity. I'll tell you about Law Abiding Citizen, and then we'll look at gay lifestyle comedy, Mr. Right. But let's start with Seraphine, because it did win 7 Césars, which was a bit of a surprise, I think, including Best Film, Best Actress, Best Original Screenplay. The Best Actress was Yolande Moreau, who was an actress sort of new to me until I saw her face, when I realised that she'd been a character actor for many, many years in many French films. This is the story of a little-known artist called Séraphine de Senlis, who was discovered by a German art critic and never quite made the big time.
Là-dedans, tout va bien, Séraphine. Moi aussi, quand je le regarde, j'ai peur de ce que j'ai fait. C'est beau, Séraphine. C'est beau.
Zan, here she certainly has made the big time with her 7 Césars. Is it a film that deserves 7 Césars?
You know, who can say, let's not quibble over the numbers, it certainly deserves a few. I like this very much. And she, you're right, she is the ultimate character actress, isn't she? And this is the interesting thing about this. This is an outsider artist who's basically a small town drudge who goes on her hands and knees scrubbing the flagstones and goes to church, and then in her spare time she spends what little money she earns on oil paints and paints these paintings that a visiting German critic celebrates as primitive art.
Yes.
Now, if this was a Hollywood movie, she would be this sort of wild, wacky, free spirit who then comes into her own. But because this is a very coarse-grained, sensitive, subtle French drama, she remains kind of willfully, resolutely uncharismatic.
Absolutely.
She is a creature of the shadows, who almost wants to stay in the shadows.
And it's unusual for films about artists, of which there are many, and most of them are kind of overrun. They kind of struggle to get the genius of both the artist and their work on the canvas.
Yeah.
This one doesn't really bother with that. There's no genius here. There's a slight devotion, if you like, because she sort of says, "My guardian angel made me do it." And she's we learn she's this former nun. I think it does it with very smooth economy. The film sets up her character, a brilliant performance, I think, because she doesn't. She's obviously a simple heart, to use a Flaubertian phrase, but she doesn't kind of play too much on the kind of, "Oh, I'm slightly autistic or savant."
Not at all.
In any
and
way.
Sometimes she's actively dislikable and unreliable. And so you never quite warm to her the way you should, because she's not wanting you to. She's keeping people at an arm's length.
A good artist or a bad artist? I mean, I didn't know her work at all. I mean, she gets grouped with Rousseau Le Douanier, whose exhibition I did see at Tate Modern not so long ago, who was also discovered by this German critic, Wilhelm Uhlder. And I didn't really know her at all.
I don't know whether a good artist or a bad artist. Certainly an interesting artist. Her paintings seem quite crude, but that, of course, is their appeal. But what was interesting about this, it reminded me a little bit of Maurice Pilliard's film about Van Gogh from about 20 years ago.
That's exactly the closeness.
And it has that sense that outsider art, primitive art, is as much a symptom of a dysfunctional personality as an antidote to the dysfunctional personality. And very sensitively and non-judgmentally, it suggests that people like this maybe are better off just being allowed to do their own thing in the quiet behind closed doors. And if you drag them into the limelight, it destroys them.
It was a sense that she needed the limelight and that it didn't come because the First World War interrupted her, and then sort of various sort of, she just wasn't fit for the art world and being exhibited in Paris, etc. And it reminded me slightly, there's a film called Samson and Delilah, which won at Cannes a certain regard. It's about Aboriginal artists as well being sort of exploited by people, and kind of, you know, you don't want to bring your Aboriginal artist to the kind of grand Sydney gallery opening. And the same one in this. And it's about the value of art.
Yeah, it's the sort of the bourgeois middle class freak show that you take this little peasant woman and say, "She's a genius. Look, she's a genius, and let's give her lots of money." And it doesn't work.
Yeah, I thought it was a very clever film, very subtly done, and I was quite a big fan of it. Really, really won me over. I thought it was very complex,
beautiful,
and full of wisdom in a very subtle way. So I'm glad that you liked it, because some people have been turned off because it's a bit sort of heritage French, bit Marchand Ivoire, if you like.
It's rustic. It's very slow paced, but it knows exactly what it's doing,
and it
totally takes you into that world.
Very sure-footed. Seraphine, starring Yolande Moreau, which I suspect might refigure when we come to look at the films of the week, Zan. But one film that everyone is talking about is Paranormal Activity, made for £3.50. It's so far recouped about $7,455 billion at the US box office. I wish, dear Film Weekly listener, I could give you the exact figures, but they expand infinitely, like a black hole, as we speak. It was made for about 10 grand in US dollars. It is basically the story of two people in their little home. The woman thinks she's being haunted by paranormal things, and the husband's a bit sceptical and sets up a video camera to record things that go bump in the night.
You cannot run from this. It will find you.
This woman, same things happen to her.
Oh, God. Breathing on me.
Looks like something bit you.
You stop following me with the camera.
I'm in control.
Zan, you scared?
I was marginally scared. I think I've become kind of inured to a lot of horror movies. You know, it's a sort of jaded palette of the teenage horror buff who then morphs into the critic who has to go and see things.
Were you a horror fan?
I think I was, yeah. Aren't most teenage boys, don't they go through a horror phase?
I think it's something to do with, you know, blood and virgins, jiggling virgins.
Jiggling virgins, yeah. Well, I'm still in that phase. But this did scare me, and it scares me because it's an ingenious idea. I mean, it's a superb idea. I mean, of course, all the parallels. Everybody reaches back for comparisons to the Blair Witch Project, which was another supposedly bit of lost footage that was found that shows the truth. But this is different, and it's a much simpler idea that it is just a static camera in the corner of the bedroom recording the lives of this couple. And it does... you know, wring a lot of terror from the most marginal, infinitesimal little events, like a door opening and closing, or somebody just standing beside a bed.
There are bits where you're jumping just because the house is creaking. Mm. I mean, every house creaks. We've all got rickety floorboards.
Yeah, and it raises the temperature in gradual degrees until you realise that you are sucked into this nightmare that they're living. I think it turns a little bit overwrought and hysterical and implausible towards the end, and maybe that is the tyranny of these kind of films, that to have that breakout hit at the box office, you need to sort of jazz it at the end to really give the horror buff their big money shot and their big payoff. But for most of the run, I thought that this was a delicate, precise, willfully subtle little film.
Is this a horror film for people who don't like horror films? Because there's no real monsters in it. It is all kind of supposition and kind of what's going on. And then it does sort of happen. Then there, a bit of horror does happen.
I think it probably is that. I think it can be read as, you know, it's basically scenes from a marriage, isn't it? But played as a horror film. It's a relationship drama. It's the boyfriend and the girlfriend. The girlfriend thinks that she was haunted as a child. Yeah. The boyfriend starts out supportive, but then starts to doubt her, and the relationship
he's
starts
supportive in a kind
breaking
of
down.
Really egotistical American way. He just wants to use his video camera that he's got.
Yeah, he's a techno nerd, and almost the third character in the film is almost the camera who he lovingly coos over and says, "Well, do you need more batteries?" And it's almost like he becomes more interested in the camera.
He wants
than
to get
her.
His shot as well. It seems to be a film about filmmaking and surveillance. I was reminded in some ways from Michael Haneke's Hidden, because we see much of the action on this speeded up kind of video as if they're looking through it in the morning. I thought that was the ingenious play here, yeah, not the actual narrative
you're
itself.
Right, and the quiet moments are the most mesmerizing in a way. Just the shot of them sleeping in the bed is almost like sort of Warhol-esque, where there's something fascinating about just watching people asleep doing nothing, but always with the pregnant suggestion that something might happen.
Zan, that's Paranormal Activity. Let me just tell you about Law Abiding Citizen, if I may.
Please do.
It's one of the big films of the week, starring Jamie Foxx and Gerard Butler. Gerard Butler is in prison. Jamie Foxx is a lawyer who's wrongly let off the people who've killed Gerard Butler's wife and child right at the beginning of the film, so there's no spoiler indeed. So Gerard's in prison, and yet still things are happening. How is he doing it?
What do you want, Clyde? You at war with the whole world? It's not going to bring anybody back?
No, I'm at war with this broken thing, this thing that brought you and I together.
This broken thing works for people that are sane. You think doing what you're doing is going to change anything? You and whoever else you have helping you are going to pay.
I don't think you have any idea who's helping me or what I'm doing.
It's a matter of time.
So you see the bodies, you see the smoke, but the larger picture still eludes you.
Do tell.
I would like to, but I would rather show you. I still have faith in you, so I'm going to give you one last chance. Here's the deal. Release me and drop all charges by 6 a.m. 6 a.m., Nick.
Or what?
Or I kill everyone.
Yes, as we heard there, Gerard Butler is in jail. Jimmy Fox is kind of keep him in jail, but yet there's still destruction going on. Do you know anything about this film?
I don't at all. I'm absolutely in the dark.
It's a kind of mix of Saw and a bit of vigilantism with Death Wish there, and a bit of Shawshank Redemption.
Now you're losing me.
Well, I hope it's not a spoiler in any way, but if I do spoil it for anyone, you know, I'm not even sorry, because you shouldn't really go and see it. It's just not very good. It's stupid. There tries to be sort of some... because it starts off about, you know, the reason that he's very annoyed, Gerard Butler, is because because he's been let down by the justice system. You know, because Jamie Foxx, who's a kind of lawyer who wants to kind of always kind of nail his victims and has a 96% conviction rate, he kind of does a plea bargain. And so one of the rapists gets off and the other one kind of goes free. And so this is disgusting that this happens.
So this is the Richard Littlejohn School of Cinema, is it? Where the world's going to hell in a handcart and a man must stand up.
Exactly. And it happens to be Gerard Butler who stands up while he's in jail. How does he do that? Now, there's a lot of this going on there because, I mean, we had Harry Brown, Michael Caine, offing hoodies the other week. Now we've got Gerard Butler sort of offing half of Philadelphia, basically, in his rampage against society. I mean, at one point he wants to blow up all of the mayor and the elders who are meeting to have this meeting about what to do with him, and he threatens to sort of blow them all up. I thought this was kind of if vigilante films become irresponsible, don't they? That's right. You know, justice system is a bit imperfect.
I think that's their USP. Vigilante films are just by nature irresponsible.
That's what we want from our vigilantes.
Well, it's what the vigilante film buff wants. I've never been mad keen on the genre. I prefer the jiggling virgins in a horror movie.
Well, exactly, and that's what's sadly lacking here.
Always very responsible.
I normally like Jamie Foxx in this, and he does get one great line in there because Gerard Butler says, "Oh, I'm going to kill someone unless I get a steak, and I want asparagus,
like a medium rare,
steak, and I want it delivered to jail. I want steak, and I want asparagus, and I want pommes frites." Mm. And then Jamie Foxx at one point just goes, "Fuck you and your pommes frites," which as an actor, that's what you want. So well done, Jamie, you got your line in, and I suppose that's the only reason for doing Law Abiding Citizen. Don't really need to go and see it. It's a DVD film on a plane or something like that.
Okay.
Zan, there is another film out this week called Mr. Right, which I think you and I might feel is Mrs. Wrong.
This was a struggle to get through.
Steven Spielberg saw about 5 minutes of this and then left.
He did, yeah. He went to the loo, I think.
Never came back. He's still there.
Doesn't this sort of take This Life down Old Compton Street, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, the adverts.
It's a sort of multi-strand ensemble drama of the gay life in London.
I think it's supposed to be an advert for gay life in London.
I think it is. There's certainly a good film to be made about the gay scene that takes us inside that and shows the interrelationships and the flow of it. But this was very stagey and clanky.
And it looks awful. It's shot in low budget. They obviously had loads of favours from all these cafes because every establishing shot is, oh, Maison Berthoud, Café D'Amato, Café Bangla. I mean, thanks for the free catering, but it's just...
It's not going to do those cafes any favours.
I hated every single person in it as well. There's a sort of dinner party from hell where all the gay guys sort of realise they've all slept with each other and they all start bitching at each other.
Yeah, they're all very catty.
Yeah,
and then catty people.
Catty people, these homosexuals, I believe, is what one of the fathers
but
calls his son.
But lovable too, as we see in this film.
But it's also difficult to be gay in Old Compton Street these days. And there's a bit where one of the characters sort of says, God, that dinner party was a bit... I mean, people will pay good money to see that on the stage.
Yes. The only straight character who comes out with that verdict and says people pay good money to see it. And you think, but they wouldn't if it looks like this.
Yeah, affected by Christmas panto spirit. Slightly early, I shouted out, oh, no, they wouldn't. Mr. Right, avoid. Zan, we've reached the end of the reviews of the week. So let's just sort of top things up. We've got Seraphine, we've got Paranormal Activity. And I suppose, I mean, I'm slightly skewed by Law Abiding Citizen, but maybe I've swayed you with a review. So let's top them up. How many stars for Seraphine?
Oh, Seraphine is a definite 4.
Yes, I'm going 4 stars, which gives it a lovely 8 or wheat, which is one more star than it got César's. Paranormal Activity, though?
I would give this 3 stars. I think it's an ingenious film. It's a flawed film, but it's certainly worth your time.
Yeah, I wanted to hate Paranormal Activity, mainly because someone's sitting on a pile of $100 million, and I'm not. But I didn't. I thought there was some skill involved in it, so I'm also going to give it 3 stars, which gives it a 6.
We're in perfect synchronicity this
week. I know what's going on. A law-abiding citizen. How many stars am I going to give that?
You're going to give that 2, I think.
I am going to give it 2, simply because Jamie Foxx has 2 X's. And then I'm going to force you to give it 2 as well.
All right, I'll give it 2. You might even give it 1. Sight unseen.
It is.
Breaking the cardinal rule.
And only because I don't want to talk about Mr. Right, because I'm going to give that no stars.
Really? That's harsh.
Yeah, it is harsh.
Wow.
I hated every single minute. I wanted to reach inside the screen with a large polo mallet.
Okay, I'm going to give it 1, but that's just because I'm just so damn generous.
So that leaves Seraphine as our film of the week with 8 stars. Huit étoiles. Is that justified?
I think that is. I think it's. This is a film that surprised me. I thought it was going to be a hard slog, and I was utterly mesmerised.
Yes, I was delighted by it, and I thought it was fascinating too. So, Seraphine, the French artist, wins over the lo-fi paranormal poltergeists. Zan, lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
For the best news and film reviews, including Zan's verdict on that Royal Film premiere, The Lovely Bones, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Now, there are certain films that, when described on paper, just don't seem like they're going to add up to an engaging cinematic experience. And Examine Life, I have to confess, is just that. It's directed by Astra Taylor, and the film is a sequence of short interviews with 8 leading philosophers. But these concentrated encounters take place not in a library or in a university lecture hall. No, Taylor takes her subjects out onto the streets of San Francisco and New York so that the film roots its ideas in the cityscape, amongst the traffic, amongst playing children and grand shops.
This is where Chekhov begins. This is where the blues starts. It's where jazz starts. You think Charlie Parker's upset because he can't sustain a harmony? He doesn't care about the harmony. He's trying to completely ride on the dissonance, ride on the blue notes. Of course, he's got harmony in terms of its interventions here and there. But why start with this obsession with wholeness? And if you can't have it, then you're disappointed and want to have a drink and melancholia and blah, 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 blah. No, you see, the blues, my kind of blues, begins with catastrophe, begins with the angel of
you history. Heard a bit of Cornel West there talking about the jazz and blues of Manhattan streets and comparing it to the philosophy and the hum of life. And well, we've got Astra Taylor, the director of Examined Life, on the streets of New York right now. Astra, thanks for joining us. Tell us exactly where you are in New York.
Thanks for having me. I am in the East Village, 3rd Avenue and St. Mark's Place, so a kind of classic spot.
A classic thinker's spot as well, because, I mean, philosophy really is about going for a walk, isn't it, really? I mean, people think of it as being in lecture halls and universities, but actually the engagement with the streets, the engagement with the people is really what your film's about.
Yeah, well, Western philosophy really sort of began in the streets with the figure of Socrates, of course, or at least as far as we know, you know, that idea of being in the street and encountering people who have different views than you and maybe unsettling them, provoking them, harassing them even. So I wanted to play on that image because there's a long history connecting, you know, walking and philosophy. Nietzsche famously loved to go for walks. We've got Walter Benjamin in Paris wandering the streets. But, you know, over the years, that image subsided. And now when we think of philosophy, we think of, as you say, classrooms, lecture halls, libraries.
And what made you think that people would want to watch a bunch of philosophers wandering around philosophizing?
I don't know what made me think that that would be the case, because I have to say I met many a blank stare and many people's eyes glazed over, and they would ask me, so what are you working on next? And I'd say, a film about walking philosophers. It was certainly a project met with skepticism in most circles, and yet a few people came on board and kind of got the concept right away, and also the subjects, the philosophers, really got it. It
yes.
was not something that I had to really work to communicate to them.
But I suppose once you had your philosophers in place, that was the key, your cast, if you like. How did you choose the philosophers that you were going to go? I mean, obviously Cornel West, you know, kind of he's kind of a rock and roll star, and Zizek as well, Slavoj Zizek, who's dubbed the Elvis of cultural theory. You have to have these kind of icons of modern philosophy in there.
Yeah, well, you know, the truth is, I thought the most difficult part was actually just deciding to take my crazy idea and share it with other people and try to get it off the ground. And actually, the philosophers, getting the cast together wasn't so difficult. I obviously could have made a lot of different philosophy movies. I could have made a philosophy of mind movie or a philosophy of language or logic. I could have had a bunch of logicians, you know, wandering around. But I wanted to speak on the theme of ethics. I wanted a film that would resonate with people's everyday experience. And so I wanted to play with this idea of, you know, what are our responsibilities to others in a globalized world.
Do you think that the current climate is inducing more philosophy in readers? Is philosophy, whether we know it or not as such, is becoming more and more part of everyday life in advertising, let's say, in ethics, in the political choices we're forced to make, in even what TV station we watch?
Well, I would say that, you know, philosophy is always around us. And that's one thing I wanted to show, was not just that you have to project philosophy into the environment by getting a sort of resident philosopher to come and talk to you about ideas, but that everything we do has a sort of philosophical underpinning. And in fact, even the way the streets that we inhabit are mapped out, whether they're accessible or inaccessible, even that sort of has a philosophical or ideological, you might want to say, underpinning.
Yes, I mean, right now it sounds to me like you've got some canine philosophy going on, and you're being savaged by a pack of wild dogs.
There's canine philosophy in the movie, so it's very appropriate.
Exactly.
There's a discussion about whether or not dogs are creating meaning. So I would say no. I would say we're encouraged not to be that philosophical in a sense, and I think that's why this film feels to some people like such an exceptional experience, right?
So your camera is very important. Tell us about the actual filming of it, almost the sort of technical aspect.
The idea of the walk really provided an opportunity for variation of scene and adventure, and also for the unexpected. Because one reason I didn't want to interview, you know, Zizek in an office with Cornel West in his office, or Judith Butler and her, you know, in a library, was that I could control the circumstances. I really wanted to not be totally in control. I wanted to know my subject, know what they were talking about, and yet hopefully get her, you know, interrupted by passersby or harassed by the police, which sadly never happened as much as I hoped that it would. Or, you know, we were chased by gutter punks at one point. I wanted things to go wrong so that we would have to respond. And also, I wanted to play with camera movement. So there's this kind of constant roving energy to the film, because what I wanted to do, even though it's about philosophy, I didn't want to sort of give the audience all the answers. Instead, I wanted to build an inquisitive momentum so that people would ask questions, debate. Maybe they loved it, maybe they hated it, maybe they loved parts, maybe they hated parts, but there would be this energy.
Well, that's the thing. You're almost like a
energy that would carry on after the film was
you've
over.
You've got a, like a compendium there, and if you don't like one philosopher or one point of view, then don't worry, because you know in 10 minutes' time a new one's going to be coming along, and a new scene, and a new kind of view of life as well. So you know, in that way, you've got that kind of portmanteau going.
I did try to keep the thing moving, you know.
Yeah, you did really well. So you could have used that dog that you've got there in the background to chase you along the street.
I have moved away from him. I'm now on my walk.
I'm worried about you. We had a clip earlier in the show of Cornel West, who I guess is my favourite of your guys. I'm a big jazz and a blues fan, and it seemed to have him talking about those things in New York, the city of jazz itself. It seemed to really work. But now he's an advisor to Obama, is that right? Did you two discuss that? I mean, is philosophy now on the agenda at the White House? Is it something we're all going to be engaging with and grappling with via Obama?
It wouldn't be bad, you know, if only he would, you know, take a lesson right from Napoleon and say all kids have to study philosophy. But I'm doubtful. I think that Cornel West came on, you know, during the campaign and now and was a critical supporter. And now he's been pretty, he's been putting some fire under Obama. I wouldn't say he's not so much an advisor. I think he's really trying to push him, you know, in a left anti-war progressive direction. So he's been doing a lot of press for his autobiography, and he's been very critical of Obama. So
yeah, absolutely. I did explain to a friend, I said, oh, I've seen this film about philosophy, and you know, the Cornel West is in it. He said, my God, that's great that Kanye's finally getting into philosophy. And I thought that we got confused between our Cornels and our Kanyes, but it either would be great, you know. You should have Kanye in your next one.
I probably should. He's made some very philosophical statements, and he's got a broad reach.
Absolutely. Then you'd have a real hit on your hand and everything. Listen, exactly. I really enjoyed it. It's great to start thinking in a movie. Not enough films these days leave you room to think, because they're all too crash-bang wallop. Astra, thanks so much for joining us from
Thank
the
you so much
streets
for
of New York.
Me.
My pleasure. Examined Life, subtitled Philosophy is in the Streets. It is on sadly limited release here in the UK. It plays at the ICA in London, but you can find out more about the film by going to zeitgeistfilms.com/examinedlife. That's all for Film Weekly this week. My thanks to all our guests, to Astra Taylor from New York and to Paul King from down the road in King's Cross. The music featured in this week's show was taken from Paul King's film, Bunny and the Ball. It's by an undiscovered English band, The Ralph Band. You can read a comprehensive list of reviews by buying this Sunday's Observer, because I'm filling in for the great Philip French and doing all the films. And as I said last week, the end of 2009 is nearly upon us. In fact, it's closer upon us than it was at the end of last week's show. We'll be compiling our best of lists as usual, but this year we want to know what you think, what should be in the top 10. Mike McKenney has already posted on our Facebook Film Weekly fans page. In the Loop and Fish Tank have to be in there, says Mike. Mark Harrington thinks Moon and Frost Nixon are contenders. What do you think? Join them by going to our Film Weekly fans page on Facebook, or you can email us film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
My old lady friend said that I was round the bend when she saw me hiding pins of blue. I said, no, I'm not. I've simply got a soft spot for sticking people's faces to their shoes.
That's the rules,
she said, and went upstairs to bed.